Hello, all you wonderfully strange and unusual creatures.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Courtney. And this is Sinister Crimes and Cocktails, a true crime show that digs into the dark depths of sinister minds, their menacing crimes, and mistakes left behind, all while sipping on a sinister cocktail masterminded by Corey for each episode.
We want to first start out by saying that our sinister cocktails featured for each episode is just to help us lighten the mood a bit on the dark and horrific crimes we cover. And in no way, shape, or form are we trying to make light of the horrific crimes. Please know our hearts go out to the victims, their families and friends, and law enforcement affected by each of the cases we cover.
Okay, Corey, what sinister cocktail have you masterminded for today's episode?
I'm calling this one an Unsolved Crimes. 2 ounces of blended rum, 1/2 ounce of brown sugar syrup, 4 mint leaves, 1 ounce of lime juice, a dash of old-fashioned bitters, and some champagne. You're going to combine that first 5 ingredients into a shaker with some ice and shake it till it's cold. Double strain into a champagne glass of your choice and top it off with a champagne. Enjoy.
I really like this one. It leaves such a nice, clean, refreshing taste on your palate. Like, it's really good.
You it's did good. A good job. You could sip on these all day long and be like, I'm good.
Yeah.
It's kind of a riff off an old Cuban, but I changed some things around, so it's pretty good.
I really like it.
If you haven't tried it and you like champagne cocktails, this is definitely one.
It is.
So, all you wonderfully strange and unusual creatures, pour yourself a cocktail and settle in for these sinister true crimes. Part 2 of Paying It Forward with Cold Cases. Believe us, you're gonna need it. We are still paying it forward this month and once again are looking at cold cases in our home state of Texas. Just like before, few details have been released to the public since they are still ongoing investigations. If you have any information regarding the cold cases we cover, please come forward and help give closure to the victims' families. At the end of today's episode, we will give you once again the contact info of where you can report any tips. Okay, Corey, you ready to dive into our first cold case for today?
Let's do it.
31-year-old Estella Salinas lived in Houston, Texas, along with her husband, Gilbert Salinas Jr., and their 3 sons, Andrew, Gilbert III, and Stephen. On Christmas Day in 1980, Estella and her oldest son, 14-year-old Andrew, had left to visit Estella's parents, Marion and Julian Ortiz, who also lived in Houston, but they never made it there. The two were last seen in a blue-colored 1972 Mercury Cougar, which Estella had been driving. On that Thursday Christmas, sometime in the later afternoon, the bodies of Estella and Andrew Salinas were found on the concrete bank of the east side of White Oak Bayou and the Pinemont Bridge. The location was near the 4500 block of Creekmont Drive and 1 mile from active railroad tracks. Both mother and son had been strangled to death. According to their death certificates, Estella died from asphyxiation due to ligature strangulation, and Andrew died from asphyxiation due to chest compression and manual strangulation.
That's pretty up close and personal and brutal, isn't it?
That really is. That's an interesting factors in this cases. I mean, obviously they're both asphyxiated, but by two different means and manners, in my opinion, because you've got one where it's strangulation ligatures, which most likely was strangled by like a rope or something like that means. But then Andrew is more of chest compression. So I almost wonder if he was on top of them and was strangling with his hands.
That's what I was wondering. I wonder if he maybe gave more of a fight and that's why he was on top of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's just really, really interesting. Or maybe he tried to escape and the person caught up to him and did that. But that's interesting. And for me, for chest compression, we're looking at Andrew is a 14-year-old kid. So, you know, he's probably basically pretty thin still, not too heavy or too big. But it wouldn't take much to compress his chest for strangulation. So that's some interesting facts.
I would agree with that.
Makes me wonder what went on during the struggle.
I would agree.
Now, why exactly it was only Estella and Andrew that had gone to visit her parents without the rest of the family on Christmas Day has never been released, and not many other details have been made public. The only other relevant information about the murders was that a family member who was not named later found Estella's blue 1972 Mercury Cougar near a fast food restaurant at the intersection of Cavalcade and East Tex Freeway about 10 miles from where their body was found. The keys to the car and Estella's personal items were still inside the vehicle.
So these are some interesting facts, too. And I almost wonder if maybe she broke down. Did the car break down? Did it run out of gas? I mean, to have all the personal effects still in there and the key. To me,
maybe they were walking,
or
why would she have left her purse?
They called a tow truck and they were waiting for a tow truck to come. And maybe the tow truck driver that picked him up had something to do with it. I mean, of course, we don't have a lot of information on this case, so we don't know a lot. But to me, I probably would be looking at the car and making sure it worked properly, making sure there was gas in it, because that might be a lead you could follow going down the line, looking at, okay, well, wait a minute. It's parked on the side of the road. The keys are in here. Her purse is in here, or whatever, whatever personal effects. It didn't say a purse, but whatever personal effects.
Have any
are in
calls
there.
Been made to tow trucks?
Yeah. Or? You know, is the car not working? Because if the car's not working right, then most likely they might have called a tow truck. And then I would have canvassed, of course, the neighborhood, wherever they were at, fast food joints. You know, there's cars in and out of that places. There's, you know, people all around. I probably would have walked around and tried a scene. And I probably went to the fast food restaurants and said, hey, do y'all have cameras? It's 1980.
They don't have cameras.
They may have, they may not have. Or at least, hey, you know, if you do have cameras over the cash registers or whatever, or do you guys remember who came in here during this time period? Is there anybody that stood out to you? Or was there anybody that, you know, sat in here, just kind of watched out the window or whatever? Did you see a tow truck come up to this vehicle? Did you see this vehicle? There have been a lot of questions asked. I'm sure these investigators did all this. I'm positive that. Of course, you're going to leave no stone unturned in these cold cases, but that's probably something I would have looked at, is definitely looked at the car and went, hey, you know, is something wrong with the car? I mean, maybe she called a tow truck, or maybe she called a tow truck for gas because she ran out of gas if there was no gas in the vehicle. And that'd just be an extra lead, but who knows? I mean, that's a sad case and it's very interesting. I really think that Andrew probably tried to run.
I would agree.
You know, and there was a struggle there with him just from the means in which he was chest compressed and manual strangulation. He did it with his hands. He was on top of him and did it with his hands. And I almost wonder if they did run out of gas, maybe somebody stopped by and said, hey, get in the car. I'll take you up to a gas station and get you what you need. Remember back in the 1980s, they were trusting.
That's
true. Yeah, of course. I'll just leave my keys here. No problem. Let's run up here, get some gas. We'll be back. Never thinking you're getting in a car with a serial killer.
Her purse was
left. Or a killer.
There.
We don't know if it's a purse. Do we know it's a purse?
It said keys and personal belongings. I'm assuming that's a purse.
Well, it might be, or maybe it was only a wallet. I mean, I don't know. Own personal belongings could be a number of things. But I would agree with you. It's probably along the lines of a purse or a wallet that is left in there.
To me, I just feel like, why wouldn't she have taken that with her?
Yeah. Well, because to me, that says that she was trusting of the person.
Maybe where they broke down or ran out of gas or whatever. Maybe they were attacked there.
Sure.
Well, no, because it was 10 miles away. And it's where they found the body. So I don't know.
To me, I would put my money on they definitely got into another vehicle somehow. And when they got in that vehicle, they didn't realize they were getting in the vehicle with a killer. And that killer took them down the road and killed them. That would be my premise of it. Because if they walked anywhere, again, that would be come from canvassing the fast food restaurant, trying to talk to patrons there, trying to talk to people who work there. Did you see this? Did you see a tow truck come up? Did they come in here and use the phone? Just remember, it's 1980. People didn't have phones in their cars. They didn't have cell phones. So they would have had to go somewhere and make a phone call. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If they did run out of gas. So those are all things I would have looked at, try to figure out, hey, okay, looking at this, let's start with, is the car working? Did it have gas in it? What was going on there? And then kind of leave from there and go from there. But I definitely think that Andrew tried to get away, and that's why asphyxiated the way he was.
All right, you ready for our second cold case?
Let's do it.
50-year-old Harold William Roland, better known as Bill, along with his wife, resided in Lufkin, Texas, but owned a lake house on Sam Rayburn in the neighboring San Augustine County. Bill was last seen on July 21, 1997, in the San Augustine County area, and according to his wife as well as a witness, Bill had told them he planned to go fishing that day. The following morning, when Bill had still not arrived back home, his wife reported him missing. Police would discover that not only was Bill missing, but so was his gray 1996 Chevrolet 271 extended cab pickup truck, his white 1994 low pontoon boat with a blue stripe and metal top, as well as his boat trailer. Over the next 3 months, Bill's missing property was discovered. First, his pickup truck was found abandoned and torched 34 miles away in a rural area of Angelina County. His boat trailer was found abandoned about 28 miles away from Lake Sam Rayburn in the San Augustine National Forest. And finally, his pontoon boat was located hidden under willow trees on Lake Sam Rayburn. The pontoons on the boat had been shot, possibly in an attempt to sink it. Despite extensive searches and interviews, Harold William Ronald has never been found, and investigators suspected that he was killed. At the time of his disappearance, he was 6 feet 2 inches tall, weighed between 250 to 260 pounds, had graying blonde hair and brown eyes. No other details have been made public.
Okay, so this one makes me itchy, scratchy, Court. I'm not going to lie. When I read over this case, I went back and see if I could find some old newspaper articles on it and stuff. I got to tell you, this one feels like Mr. Bill might have faked his own death.
Just ran away.
And ran away, and for whatever his reasonings were. So this is an interesting case. I am sure the investigators up there in that area have thought this too, and have wondered this since there was no body found. It has never been found. And I feel bad for Bill's family, because I am sure that they are at a loss. You know, they don't really know whatever happened to him, so there's no peace there. But this screams like...
another life.
Yeah. And what I know now to what I know then, I mean, this was all very well planned out. And, you know, for as much damage as it was done to his property and not his body and never being found or him never being found, that's very calculating, very interesting.
I can see that.
When I first read it, I almost thought, well, maybe it's cartel, because this is kind of a cartel kind of way of doing things, right? But you find a body.
Eventually, you'll
there's
find.
Always, yeah, there's always bodies to go with it. And this, no body. So it makes me wonder, But I mean, I feel bad for Bill's family. Hopefully they will find him in one way or the other to give him some peace, because I'm sure they've been tortured with this for a very long time.
I would agree. I wonder, do you think they dredged the lake looking for his...
I'm sure they did a lot of things. I mean, I'm sure they looked, they dived, they, you know, try to figure out what was going on. And lakes are difficult. You know, there's all kinds of things underneath lakes that people don't realize. And bodies can go disappearing in lakes and never be found because of the intertwining of trees and stuff underneath them.
As they say, all sorts roots. Of branches, oh, roots. Yeah.
And bodies become buoyant too, so they will float after a certain amount of time, as long as they're not tangled up or caught in anything or tied to anything. I'm sure they dredged the lakes. I'm sure they looked for everything possible way to find him, because you put in here they did extensive searching, so I'm sure they did. But that's why it makes me almost wonder. Just saying.
Yep.
I also would have liked to know how many bullet holes were in the boat.
In the pontoons.
I'd like to know that.
And release that.
Yeah, I'd also like to know how many casings were found around that area.
Or if any,
yeah. Because if somebody's cleaned up after themselves, it always makes me wonder.
Yep.
Good case. They find Bill.
Me too. You ready for our third one?
Let's do it.
In August of 1984, 39-year-old Maria Faye Mendez, a mother of three, was reported missing from her Odessa, Texas apartment located in the 2400 block of West 10th Street. Within days of her disappearance, her family reported her missing after she did not come home and failed to contact them. The original investigation team conducted interviews and canvasses, but the case quickly went cold. 6 years later, on January 1st, 1990, about 40 miles away from Odessa, unidentified human remains were found in Crane County, Texas. The human remains were determined to be a female of an unknown race and between 16 and 21 years old. In 2013, with the help of the Crane County Sheriff's Office, the Odessa Police Department submitted the remains for DNA testing and anthropological research, along with entering the DNA into a database, but no matches were made. However, in 2022, the Odessa Police Department obtained samples of DNA from living relatives of Maria Mendez, and in January of 2023, the University of North Texas Center of Human Identification notified the Odessa Police Department of a DNA match. The DNA match was that of the skeletal remains recovered in Crane County, Texas, from January of 1990. The assumed murder remains an open homicide case, and investigators have been working closely with Maria's family, but so far, no arrests have been made, nor have any other details been made public.
Yeah, this case is interesting because of where it took place at. I mean, that's kind of, back then in those days, Odessa area was kind of a no man's land just because it was really heavily oiled.
Kind of still is.
Yeah, it kind of still is, but I mean, there was a lot of just oil stuff out there. The town wasn't very big, you know, significantly grown. It got a lot bigger, but there's a lot of space out there. So it makes me wonder just how much ties, you know, she had into her community and that kind of stuff and what happened. I mean, because this is an interesting case that she went missing and she's a mother of three, right? So I'm sure.
It seemed weird that they waited so long.
Me too. But I mean, it makes me wonder kind of about her background. Maybe she wasn't exactly the most in-tuned person.
I was going to say Donna Reed mother.
Yeah. You know, she may have been, you know, one of those people that were having issues.
I was going to say, she could have been suffering from her own
issues.
We don't know.
Yeah. We don't know. Because it did take the family quite a bit of time to report her missing.
So it seems like maybe this wasn't necessarily something that was new or really troubled them at first. Maybe she'd taken off a couple of times before.
Yeah. I mean, there's got to be more details to this case, but it's very sad. And to take as long as it did to identify her remains is even sadder.
Oh, I know.
You know, I mean, but thank God for DNA, right?
No,
I mean, that's what's awesome about DNA. And it's starting to really turn a corner in investigations of crimes upside down. And I love it.
Yeah, especially for cold cases. I mean, it's really helping a lot.
I mean, it has really come along and solved some really old cold cases. I know I sent you one the other day.
We're 50-year-old.
Yeah, we're going to do it. But a 50-year-old cold case solved. I mean, that's amazing.
Amazing.
That's so amazing. So it's really exciting to be on this side of it and in this day and time court going through these cases, because it's just awesome how eventually they will get solved.
Yep, I agree. All right, you ready for our fourth cold case?
Let's do it.
17-year-old Carol Reed, a student at Hannah High School and single mother to a 9-month-old, was last seen around 9:20 p.m. on Sunday, December 6, 1993. She reportedly had been walking with two other people into the Old Lopez supermarket off Ringgold Street in downtown Brownsville, Texas, buying three bottles of Coca-Cola. The next day on December 7, 1993, Carol's body was found by highway crews on the outskirts of Brownsville off FM Road 1421, south of Highway 7783. She had been discovered wearing only a pair of tennis shorts and a Mickey Mouse watch with no identification. Articles of her clothing were found discarded along the road. With no identification and semi-nude, Carol's belongings were aired on local news stations in hopes of discovering her identity. However, her family and friends received the heartbreaking news along with the masses. That's fucking terrible.
Oh, yeah. Terrible way to find out that you've lost your loved one that way.
Yep. Carol's sister, Jessica Belton, told the press that she knew her sister had been murdered even before authorities contacted her family, when she had seen the televised news images of her sister's clothing strewn on the side of the lonely back road. Foul play was instantly suspected, and the Brownsville Police Department reported to the Valley Morning Star that Carol was believed to have been strangled, as she had bruising and marks around her neck. Authorities speculated that Carol had been dead for approximately 12 hours before her body was discovered, and that she had more than likely been left on the side of the road moments before her death. The supermarket that Carol visited with the two other individuals did have a surveillance camera, but unfortunately, there was no tape inside the camera at the time Carol was in the store. That's fucking unfortunate.
That is a terrible, terrible twist of fate on that one.
The district attorney's office has not released the details of her autopsy, but said she was not sexually assaulted. I'm sorry, I have a hard time believing this, that she was only found in a pair of shorts and a Mickey Mouse watch and she wasn't sexually assaulted.
You know, I mean, if it never got to the point of penetration and she ran and they killed her to keep her quiet quickly, I mean, I can see that, you know, or maybe, you know, you're in the back of a car and things are going the way they're going and then all of a sudden you don't want it no more and you try to get away and he's pissed or she's pissed, whoever is killing you. You try to get away, they run after you real quick and they kill you. I mean, there's all kinds of ways through this where she wasn't exactly sexually assaulted. Or she's not showing signs of it. Doesn't mean that she wasn't groped. Doesn't mean she wasn't improperly treated. It just means that there was no
penetration.
They don't have any kind of signs of that.
Okay. Now, authorities, along with the district attorney's office, believe that the motive in Carol's death may have been retaliation. Investigators reported that 41-year-old Jorge Medina is a suspect in Carol Reed's murder, but to date, the authorities have been unable to determine his whereabouts. Now, there's no reports of how they figured that up, so I don't know.
They've got to be very, very careful. Definitely, 100%. And that's one thing that our listeners need to understand about cold cases. They have to be very careful about the information that they let out. Because when you have a cold case, you get callers who call in and will tell you all kinds of crazy shit. It literally brings out the crazies. I'm not going to lie. It does. Because people are dying to be relevant with something. And when they see something like this on the news and it's a big case and it's getting a lot of media attention, all of a sudden they feel like they can be relevant. And when you've got somebody who's struggling with mental illness and that's struggling with wanting to be relevant, all of a sudden, hey, I'm going to figure my way into this. And so you have to be careful about the details you let out, because the real person who did this is going to only have the specific details. They're only going to know specific details. And if you let those specific details out, you're never going to be able to weed out the bad to the good. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So that's one thing that our listeners need to understand with cold cases. It's why there's very little information out there that they're letting out. That's important.
There is a $10,000 cash reward for information about Carol Reed's case or for Jorge Medina's whereabouts, and all tips can be made to the Cameron County District Attorney's Office at 956-544-0849. Okay, are you ready for our very minute, detailed fifth case?
Let's do it.
On November 30th, 1997, the body of truck driver Kenneth Minton, who was believed to have been heading to Florida with a load, was discovered behind the Junction Restaurant in the northeast corner of IH-10 and US-83,
which is the longest numbered highway in Texas, running 906 miles long. It's fucking long.
That's very long.
That's why we don't leave Texas, people. Because it's a long stretch to get out of it if you're driving.
Yeah, drive fucking a whole day and still never get out of Texas.
No shit.
His cause of death was from apparent gunshot wounds, and it is believed that the suspects attempted to conceal the crime but were unsuccessful. No other details have been released other than authorities stating that advancements in technology and forensics evidence have been utilized to further the investigation. There's also no picture for him, just to go ahead and let you know that.
So this is interesting. What really catches me here is that I would love to know their point of view on why the suspect attempted to conceal the crime but was unsuccessful. I mean, what was their thought process on that? And of course, we have very little detail.
This is literally all I can find. Yeah, and I searched and searched forever, and this is all I can find.
I looked also into the county to see if I could pull anything off of public websites for the county, but I couldn't find anything that would have to do with this case, you know, because of course there's been no real breakthrough. I was hoping I could at least get like maybe like a search warrant or like something like that. I got nothing. Zilch. But what I really find interesting too is that there's been no further details released, but then authorities are stating that in advancements in technology and forensics evidence, they've utilized it to further their investigation. So they've got to have something. To me, that tells me they've got either a DNA profile or they've got blood or they've got some hair. They've got some kind of evidence on this guy's body that's going to help them. And so they're releasing very little details because they're trying to figure it out. The case overall, you know, he's believed to heading to Florida. He was shot. I mean, he's a trucker. Who knows? You know, it could have been a robbery gone wrong kind of thing. And the guy fled.
See, this restaurant, from where it's located, it's out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. It's a truck stop restaurant. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, so to think about how many people come and go from in there.
Oh, yeah. Your search widens completely. Like now you're searching the whole United States, a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
Right. But it does make me wonder. I bet they've got some kind of DNA, some kind of hair, something that can help them, you know, with advancements in forensic evidence. That kind of statement tells me they've got something that can link them to somebody. But they may not be able to find them yet because, you know, maybe there's nobody to nail them to. But there's going to be some kind of advancement pretty soon, I bet.
I would agree. Are you ready to look at the next case?
Let's do it.
For our final Texas cold case, we are looking at one that hits close to home, as a friend of mine asked us to look into his relative's murder. On Tuesday, November 6, 2002, 24-year-old Christina Michelle Gowans Nance was last seen around midnight leaving a popular club, or in some reports called it a bar, in the 1700 block of North Laurent in Victoria, Texas. Around noon the next day, on November 7, 2002, a resident of the city who had been walking discovered Christina's partially clothed body in some weeds on the bank of Spring Creek, near the country club at the intersection of Spring Creek Drive, just east of the railroad tracks off of North Main Street. The distance between the bar Christina left and where her body was found is about a distance of 4.5 miles. Christina's removed pieces of clothing were found near her body. As officers were on their way to the crime scene, a friend who had been out with Christina the night before reported her missing. Victoria's chief of police at the time, Tim Brayton, told the press that investigators could account for Christina's whereabouts for about 36 hours before her body was found, and that they had been able to determine that other people had seen Christina after her friend had last seen her leaving the bar around midnight. Brayton stated that there were some indications that her death wasn't natural. Now, while he would not speculate on the cause of death, he did say it was nothing obvious, and it did not appear that she had drowned in the rising water. Scent tracking hounds were brought in from an area prison to check the area where the walker had discovered Christina's body. However, no information has been released to the findings, nor have the details about how Christina got to the area where her body was discovered have been released. In 2003, the Victoria Police Department revealed that Christina's cause of death was determined by strangulation. Okay, right here, this is where I want to say where I think the case gets fucked up. And I know I have probably more of an emotional attachment to this because it's a friend of mine's relative. But fucking Brayton, you said there was no obvious cause of death. That's fucking bullshit. If she died of strangulation, there were marks around her fucking neck. There were marks on her. So either you're a shitty fucking detective or you just refuse to give those details out at the very beginning.
Well, it's probably more of a, they refuse to give those details out at the beginning because when the case is in its infancy court, they're going to release very minimal amount of details, trying to catch the right person. Like I just explained, when it becomes a big media and you're talking about Victoria, what people don't know about Victoria is Victoria is also a college town. It's the home of the University of Houston, Victoria campus. So it's got a lot of kids there. It's also got a junior, I think it's got a junior college
there. I think they do have a junior college. I think they have a
junior college there, if I'm not mistaken, or at least an outlet of junior college. So there's a lot of people in Victoria, and there's a lot of clubs, and I've been to Victoria 100,000 times. I've been there a lot. But it's off of a big highway that has a lot of traffic going through it. Also a lot of back road highways that kind of, you know, go through it and kind of branch off from it. So, you know, it's very easily something that I could see why they minimize their information they let out at first, because you're in the infancy of what's going on. You're trying to figure out the case. You don't want to let too much information out in case you start to get a lead and you follow that lead. All of a sudden, they've let out too much information and now they can't weed through the good and the bad.
I get that.
On that point. But yes, I mean, when he comes back and they release the information, the cause of death, because they have to, they don't have a choice once the autopsy report comes out and they make it a homicide, you know, then all of a sudden, okay, now we have to figure out what amount of information we're going to let out to where we can still weed out the good and bad. On that note, on that side of it, I'm not saying they didn't mess up this investigation. I'm just saying on that note right there, that's how I'm explaining that part of it. From what I can speculate about this death is I would tell you, of course, everything would be speculation. But what I will tell you is that I think that she was at the bar. I think that she was probably left the bar with whoever assaulted her. I think it went wrong. And either she said no or she didn't want to do it. And that person lost their shit and wound up killing her.
That's what I think happened.
Then wound up taking off. And because it's a college town, this person could be living anywhere in the world. We don't know. Right. And so that's where cases can sometimes go really cold, is because you have very limited amount. Now, I don't know if there was DNA collected off of her. I don't know if there was a hair collected off of her.
Can I just say this?
Go ahead.
I hope that the Victoria Police Department were able to collect DNA properly so that way later it could be tested or entered into a database for now to be able to be matched up.
Sure.
And I really hope that that happens.
I do too. I kind of want to go back with this a little bit. I'm not making excuses for police departments. Lord knows. They have their fuck ups. But what I will tell you is that the time and dates in which we're talking about these cold cases, DNA, DNA profiling, that kind of stuff was like very much in a younger stage.
Yes.
It's not where it is today. And we are still today, court, having breakthroughs with DNA, with cold cases, all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure eventually they will get to a point where they can start solving crimes with the newest thing on the block, which is familial DNA, is where they're taking DNA samples, putting it into these databases like 23andMe, Ancestry, whoever else tests your DNA, and comparing it. But that takes time and effort.
It does.
And it takes a lot of investigation. When you talk about something like this, you're talking about not only does it take somebody who is willing to sit down, go through the family history, but it goes through case by case. And it goes through, here's my DNA profile. I've got to have a lab that's willing to keep testing the DNA. I've got to have time and people willing to keep putting in the time to deal with this. So it's not that simple. It's not a simple process. And it takes years sometimes. I think the first case ever solved by it took years through familial DNA. So it's not just something that can happen overnight, unfortunately.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Now, at the time of Christina's death, she was married to Chuck Nance and was the mother of two twin boys. Christina's killer has never been caught.
You know, and I gotta tell you, unfortunately, usually the husband's the first one we look at. So I'm not saying that he had anything to do with it. I don't know. I have no idea. But usually that's a suspect. You know, when you're married and you got kids and you're at a bar, makes me wonder.
I would agree.
You know, makes me wonder. This is a tough case, and I feel for your friend. I understand not having the answers. It's hard when you have somebody who you're married to and they have kids and they're moving on, but these kids are older now, so I'd be interested in knowing if they're following up on their mom's death.
I'd be wondering that too.
Well, now, if you have any information about these cold cases or unsolved murders that we have talked about in this podcast, please, please give the call. Shout out to the Texas Rangers cold case website. It's www.dpstexas.gov, Texas Rangers Unsolved Homicides. Or call the Missing Persons Clearinghouse at 1-800-346-3243. Or, of course, the Crime Stopper hotline at 1-800-252-TIPS. Well, as always,
stay strange and unusual. And we hope this helps.
Yep, I do.
We'll be back next week with another cocktail and a new tale of sinister minds, their menacing crimes, and mistakes they left behind. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to subscribe and download us on Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite show.
Want the recipe to try Corey's sinister cocktail from today's episode? Or have any constructive feedback or true crime stories you would like to hear us cover? Or even sinister cocktail recipes for us to try? Email us at sinistercrimesandcocktails@gmail.com. Visit our website, www.sinistercrimesandcocktailspodcast.com, Facebook page, Sinister Crimes and Cocktails, and our Instagram page, Sinister Crimes and Cocktails.
Love what you heard? and want to help support our show or donate to our Sinister Cocktail Fund, you can donate to our Cash App at @SinisterCrimes, all one word. And we will give you a shout out on our next episode and which fund you donate to. Thank you.